never say die. That's the ultimate proclamation of triumph and will. But never saying die means never talking about death. And let's face it, that can get pretty heavy. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're meeting with a few members of Kansas City's Death Cafe. That is, regular people who get together to eat, drink, and talk about death. We'll hear how acknowledging mortality affects their lives. Later in the hour, we'll check in with our Tell KCUR series, sharing your thoughts on the Chief's name. Plus, hear about football player Eddie Kennison, who will always call Kansas City home. That's coming up right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've got a full show for you this morning. Later in the hour, we'll hear how our listeners weighed in on the Chief's name in light of the Redskins controversy. We'll also hear the story of wide receiver Eddie Kennison coming to Kansas City and deciding to make our city home. But for now, let's talk about death. I'm joined by hosts of local death cafes. Let me welcome Megan Mooney, who hosts these events in St. Joe. She has a master's in social work and does end-of-life research for the University of Missouri. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Can you start by explaining what happens at a death cafe? Where do people go? What happens when they get there? Set the scene for us.
Okay, so a death cafe is just a pop-up event where people get together and talk about death and dying and what's ever on their mind. A death cafe is, we do not have any agendas, there's no ideology, there's no topics. It's just a safe place for people to get together and talk about death.
How long have you been hosting these events?
I started hosting mine in March of 2013.
And what prompted you to get started?
I had heard about them from a coworker, and it was right when they had started. I started mine, it was the 60th Death Cafe to happen around the world. And I was really passionate about this because I had had a lot of experiences in death, a lot of people around me that had died that were close to me. And also my uncle and aunt had both died of cancer within 5 months of each other. And my uncle had a really bad death. And having to see everything that he went through was terrible for me and my family. And so something that I just really wanted to start so that people could get together and talk about death. And I wanted to help take that taboo off of death. And being a social worker, I feel that it's very important to bring about social change in our society. And the Death Cafe principles really go along with that.
Well, I want to turn to another guest who's with us here in the studio. She can probably relate to some of this, so I want to get her in on the conversation. Jill Bedell is with us from Signature Funerals, where she works as a funeral director. She's recently started a death cafe here in Kansas City. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for being here. Let me ask you the same question. What prompted you to start hosting death cafes?
Well, I'm in about the fourth year of the funeral profession now at this point in time, and I've met with so many families and noticing the difference between the families who've had that life discussion, the discussion of death when they come in, as opposed to the families that really didn't talk about it so much before they have to come in and actually make funeral arrangements. The difference is astounding in the experiences that they choose and what they their entire funeral experience.
You mentioned that you're 4 years in. You do seem pretty young. Do you mind me asking how old you are?
28.
Can you tell me a little bit about your decision to go into the profession of being a funeral director?
Sure, absolutely. Well, when I was young, my parents did die. I was adopted into a wonderful family. But between my adoptive family and my birth family, I had the blessing of having a lot of grandparents. I had four grandmas, four great-grandmas, and three grandfathers. So throughout the course of my upbringing, many of them died, as is what happens when you get old.
Yeah, it is what happens.
So, you know, if you think about the developmental stages of your life growing up and experiencing these different death at different times in your life. And also, you know, to pay tribute to a grandmother of mine who's a babysitter, you know, a typical day, Grandma Lois, she would say, "Jill, my friend Martha died, and today I'm going to have you go to the funeral with me. And you can sit there and listen to them sing How Great Thou Art. And then we're going to go to the church basement and you're going to help serve open-faced pimento cheese sandwiches. And then eat as many brownies as you want. And then we're going to go to the farm and watch the crops grow." I mean, that was a typical day for Grandma, but I think she also wanted me to know that death happens any time, and it's okay to make it a part of your life, and you can, you know, it's an experience that everybody has to have. So why not be a part of it?
You're pretty comfortable with the subject matter then, but you know, we all sort of specialize in life eventually in our careers, and most of us go unquestioned when we do. A dentist doesn't have to tirelessly answer for an interest in teeth. I mean, I don't think so anyway. But I'm guessing your interest in death raises some eyebrows socially.
You know, it's true. A lot of people ask you, why are you a funeral director? And really, it's why not? I just want people to have a good experience. I mean, I don't know what else to say about that.
But. Yeah. So the death cafes, back to that. Just give me your explanation for sort of setting the scene of what happens at a death cafe hosted in your funeral home.
Sure, yeah. And we had a lovely event yesterday evening. Group of, I think there were 17 of us that showed up. And the demographic was varied pretty much, although it would have been great to get a few more younger folks there. But the setting is in a Kathy, when she first started up, was a wonderful interior decorator. It looks like a boutique cafe setting when you walk in, so it's easy for folks to feel comfortable. And we gathered around in small groups. I switched us up about midway through just so that folks could get a different perspective. You know, last night, I won't go into detail about, you know, the things that we talked about, but, and each death cafe is different depending on the attendees. It's the attendees that set the discussion, but we covered everything from, end of life care in the hospice setting last night, to natural burial, to what to say to somebody at a funeral, or how to bring up the topic of death when somebody's experiencing grief. So soon after a death, what do you say?
I'm interested in the
anything.
17 people who came. I know you may not feel comfortable divulging their personal information,
right,
but
right.
What are some of the kinds of reasons you sensed people were coming to this event?
I just think a lot of folks wanted that permission, wanted to know that it's normal to talk about death, and it can be. And so just to be able to create a comfortable setting, so that folks can come and know that this is going to be a normal topic of discussion, where they don't have to feel uncomfortable about sharing any thoughts or experiences they've had, is great. So I think a lot of people showed up based on things that they were going through at the time, and that's what was discussed, whatever was on their mind.
I want to get Megan Mooney back in on this because she's been hosting these death cafes for quite a while. Megan, what do you think? Can you tell us some stories about people who have come to these events with very particular kinds of needs and very particular kinds of things they've wanted to talk about?
Yeah. Well, at my death cafes, the demographics are usually between, I have people that come between their 20s to usually their 70s. And the oldest person I've probably had at mine was about 87 years old. I have had someone who had a terminal illness at mine, and that was only one time. And the thing that I love about hosting them is people will come up to me afterwards and thank me for providing a safe place for them to come talk about death and dying, because they'll tell me that they try to talk about it to their friends or family and get told that they're morbid, or, you know, something to that effect. And they just have this desire to talk about it. And we're all going to die. And so why can't we talk about it? And we live in such a death-denying culture. And I think it's because, you know, John Underwood, who's the founder of Death Cafe, he always says, you know, there's this superstition that if we talk about death, that we invite it closer to us.
Do you think that is prevalent in our society?
I really do. And I think the reason why is because, you know, a century ago and before modern medicine, you know, death was much more common and much more seen in our society. And people died at home and we took care of our loved ones. But now people are dying, you know, behind closed doors in the hospital, you know, by medical staff a lot of the times. And so it's just something that's kind of pushed away out of the mind. And it's, you know, people don't want to accept that it's going to happen to them. It's like, well, yeah, that happened to my friend's dad, but that's not going to happen to me. You know, and maybe that's a self-protecting thing in your mind, but really by talking about death and you end up talking about life, and it's a freeing thing because then you're able to live your life in the moment.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah. You
mentioned that, that there's a founder of the Death Cafe, and some of our listeners may not know that this is actually an international movement, so to speak. Can you explain the movement, as it were?
Yeah. So in 2011, John Underwood and his mom, Subarsky Reed, actually started Death Cafe, and we have a website. It's deathcafe.com. And how this started was it's based on the ideas of Bernard Courtois, who's a Swiss sociologist, and he had started doing cafe mortels. And so he'd been doing them for quite a while. And John Underwood had read about them in The Independent in 2010, and he had already been working on some death projects. And that was something that really stuck out to him, that this is something I want to do. So he changed it a little bit, and him and his mom, who's a psychotherapist, they started some guidelines on how to run and start your own death cafe. And John started deathcafe.com. And so anyone can start your own death cafe. You just have to agree to the guidelines, which are very simple, which are just, you know, we don't want people to have the topics or guest speakers or things of that nature. And the reason why is because we find it so disempowering, because when it comes to death, people already have so much on their mind that they want to talk about.
Right. They want to talk about being the key thing there. And Jill, who's sitting here in the studio with me, I want to ask you something. Megan was just talking about how some of the reasons why maybe we don't feel as comfortable as we could talking about death, and that we don't experience it and witness it in kind of the way that maybe people used to. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Some people might argue that with the notion that death is something we need to talk about. Some people might say that talking about death puts a damper on life, that we should go, 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 live life to its fullest until death shows up and calls game over. How would you respond to that? Jill?
All I know is that I haven't been given the right to know how much longer I'm going to be present on this earth. Something could happen to me at any time. So what I know is that the fact that I do recognize more my mortality doesn't make my perspective more morbid. It just makes me, in my eyes, realistic. So when I'm able to talk about death as a part of life, as is so normal in many other cultures, I become a more productive person. My life quality increases.
What about you, listeners? Do you think that more openness about death and grieving would make us healthier, happier mortals, or would you just as soon not discuss it? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. That number again is 816-235-2888. We'll be getting to your calls in a little while. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Death Cafe hosts Megan Mooney and Jill Bedell. We are talking about you guessed it, death. And Jill, you were just mentioning that other cultures handle death differently. Talk about that a little more.
Well, yeah, I mean, each culture is a little bit different. And cultures change, too. And I think just one of the things that has maybe changed a little bit in our own, it are some of our own death practices, where that's been from religious beliefs or just common social normities changing. And that happens. But I think we just need to bring some of that back in and make death more part of a life topic.
Megan,
I was going to ask if I could jump in.
Please.
And what I was saying actually was, I feel and what I believe is that by talking about death, you end up living more life to the fullest. And I know that for myself that I found that true. And also, I have program evaluations for my death cafes, and one of the questions is, has your view on death changed? And most people write no, but my view on life has changed.
Interesting. Can you unpack that a little bit for us? You said that you've experienced that yourself. How have you experienced that?
Well, there's things that before I would have put off, or opportunities that I've gotten that I would have been like, oh, you know, I'm too afraid to do that, you know. And now I'm like, you know what, I'm going to face these fears, and I'm going to do this, and this is really important to me, and you know what, this is really trivial, and I'm, you know, I realize what is important, what is not important, and I could die at any moment, and I know that, and like Jill said, that's not a morbid thought, that's a realistic thought, and like Jill, I'm young as well, I'm 31, and but it's something that it's just very awakening, empowering, just to know that what is important in life and what is not important in life. Because I feel that a lot of people go through life and maybe not knowing what, you know, I think that sometimes it's easy to get sucked into things that are trivial. And when you realize that I could die tomorrow, you know, that's not important to me, but this is important to me.
You have a master's in social work, and you do end-of-life research. Could you talk a little bit about your research?
Yeah, I work on an NIH grant for the University of Missouri, and I work in collaboration with a hospice. And so I work mostly with hospice caregivers. And that was another reason why starting a death cafe was important to me, because I've seen how much hospice caregivers, their social support system goes down. And the reason why that is because people feel really uncomfortable about death and talking to people who are going through a loved one dying, and they don't know what to say.
Can you give people some advice on that, or is that something that you'd have to know the people and the circumstances better to discuss?
Well, I feel like it's just, you know, just being there for someone, just letting them listen, you know, just showing up and letting them talk. But I feel like so many times people are really uncomfortable with that, and they feel like they need to fix them or give them an answer. And that's the same with bereavement. When people are grieving, they don't know what to say. And sometimes they're well-meaning, but they end up saying things that are more harmful. But really, they just need to be present and to listen. But because they're afraid and they don't really want to hear it, they just avoid them. And so I feel like the more that we're able to have these death conversations, the more that people will be there for these caregivers or for people that are grieving. Just to even listen to them, because that's really what they need, is someone to listen.
Yeah, and you were talking about the program evaluations, and we do tend to pass those out at the end. And one of the trends that I was definitely seeing when I was looking at them was that people were just surprised and so pleased to know that other people were having a lot of the same thoughts. Like,
right.
It says right on there, I had the same thoughts as a lot of other folks that attended.
And Jill, maybe you can also share some of this Megan was just talking about what she witnessed among hospice workers just doing her research.
Sorry, hospice. I'm talking about hospice family
caregivers. Oh, hospice family caregivers. But, but Jill, you're a funeral director. What are the kinds of things you witness as a result of maybe inability to talk about death?
Oh, just different family dynamics. You know, like I said, going back to the caregivers, I think the Death Cafe is often just an awesome outlet for that discussion because the caregivers are often in an environment where, you know, they're always having to be conscious about what they're saying around these families. So being able to just come to an open discussion and not necessarily have to be conscious, but just, you know, to be in the present and be able to discuss whatever you're actually feeling.
And to think about their own feelings and not be worrying so much about someone else.
Exactly. And it's outside, you know, being outside of the job, you know, what you've been hired to do.
And are you both going to Hong Kong soon? You've been invited to Hong Kong for a presentation.
I just got back from Hong Kong. Lizzie Miles, who is the person who brought Death Cafe to the United States, and she was the first person to bring it out of the UK. She brought it in 2012. Her and I just got back from Hong Kong. So we did a presentation at the International Grief and Bereavement Conference on Death Cafe. And then we also helped some people there, local people there, start the first Death Cafe in Hong Kong. And it was an amazing experience.
You know, death, for as universal as it is, it also comes with a lot of cultural baggage. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about just your experience in Hong Kong and maybe some different perspectives you might have gained or areas where you just couldn't relate. Either one.
It was so amazing. And their cultural differences are very different. And then some are alike. They're very death denying in the fact that they don't like to talk about death, but there's a lot of things in their society that are really based on death. So it's kind of strange, but it's illegal to die at home there.
Whoa.
We found that out.
You know what, Megan, we're going to get back to some of these other differences when we come back, and we'll also be bringing our callers in at that point. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us whether you'd like to talk more about death or if you'd just as soon not. This is Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I am Gina Kaufman here with Megan Mooney and Jill Bedell. They are both hosts of Death Cafes here in our area. Death Cafes are places where people can come and bring whatever's on their mind surrounding ideas of death and dying, grief and grieving, and find a welcome place to discuss it without judgment. And we'd like to hear from you about that subject, 816-235-2888. And I'd like to continue hearing from Megan Mooney about the presentation she just gave in Hong Kong at a death cafe there.
Yeah, so Lizzie and I gave our presentation at the International Grief and Bereavement Conference, which was amazing. There was people from all over the world there, and people were very interested in it. And so we had some people that wanted help on starting their own. But then we got to be a part of the first death cafe in Hong Kong. And that was the most amazing experience because there was people from all over the world there. And I sat at one table that was all in Cantonese, that spoke in all Cantonese, and someone translated for me. And that was just unbelievable, an experience for me. And then I was at another table with people from New Zealand and the Netherlands. And so I just got to learn so much about different areas of the world.
Is there anything you heard from someone that you would be hard-pressed to imagine someone in America saying something that felt very culturally specific and very new to you?
Well, I guess, you know, we learned about, you know, that it was illegal to die in China, and that was something I never knew.
What do you mean by illegal to die?
Oh, sorry, not illegal to die. Illegal to die at home. It's illegal to die at home
okay.
in China. And then also I was talking to a lady from New Zealand, and she was at the conference, and she works with parents who have just their babies have just died, and she had had a miscarriage or stillbirth, and she was able to take her baby home from the hospital with her for 3 days until she decided what she wanted to do. And she was telling me that over there, you can just take your dead loved ones home, even if they're adult, for a few days. And so I thought, wow, that is just amazing. And I was talking to Jill about this yesterday, and she was telling me about the process that we would have to go through over here if we wanted to do that.
Jill, what would that process be?
Well, they're different. I mean, sometimes it's kind of hard, and there are some laws, and they vary state to state. But yeah, I mean, if it's a desire of a family member to have a service within the home, or to have at least some of the death care servicing within the home, I mean, it is definitely a possibility and can be worked around for the most part if that's something that a family really wants.
Well, I'm going to bring some callers in on this conversation. We've got Lexi with us from Blue Springs, Missouri. Hi, Lexi.
Hi there. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here and listening to you guys. It's amazing and perfect timing in light of my current situation. So thank you.
What is your current situation?
2 years ago, my mom had a massive stroke that leaves her disabled and dependent on, on someone for full-time care. And we took her home, and she is in my care. And I apologize. I don't know why it's emotional.
Oh, it's totally understandable.
That happens all the time.
Thank you.
There's laughter and tears. It all happens.
Thank you. So she came home to this. She came home, and my family, my husband and I, and my parents have 4 children. My dad is gone. And so just the 4 of us kids, and, we took care of her. And earlier this year, hospice, a friend of ours recommended me to contact hospice. And so hospice came, and I think for the rest of us, and I'm one of those people who didn't realize how important and invaluable hospice service is. Because prior to this time, I always thought hospice is when someone is near death, or it's the very final end. And I didn't realize that there is a time period before you get there. So hospice, right, which has been wonderful in educating us, in helping us understand, and in helping us also to accept, what we need to be prepared for my mom as well as for us.
Lexi,
Yeah,
I have a question for you, because some of our guests have been talking about how discussing death and really embracing death can help you live life differently. And I wonder if that's something you've experienced in any way.
Okay. I am at the stage where I find it, a little bit about my background. I'm Vietnamese American, and we grew up as a Buddhist family. So we have always dealt with, life and death as a matter of fact, nothing to be shy about. However, there was not the discussion of what do you do when you face the issue, so it was just, it's a matter of fact event, but not a discussion. So watching my mom through this process and seeing how, her being at home, seeing the decline in her health made all of this so real to me. And I was struggling quite a bit when hospice said you need to accept what your mom wants and not what you want. And the balance I have is, earlier in the conversation, I think there was a question of, do we talk about death or do we tuck it away? But at the same token, you want to live life to the fullest. So it's a balance. And I'm trying, and I'm so glad to hear that there are death cafes here. So I definitely will come out and meet with you all to talk about that. I'm dealing with the issue of, on the one hand, I want to live life in the fullest, but on the other hand, how do I balance it to know that,
you're
going to die.
Lexi, yeah. Let's let our guests address that. Jill.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, I guess all I can say is that sometimes we have to talk about death objectively and in a more practical way. And sometimes we can share more of the subjectivity and the hypothetical questions that we have about death. And so it's just nice that you've gotten care and have become surrounded by a support system that is able to give you some of those tools and those objectives to be able to handle the death as it comes. And that's really important to get that support.
Megan, what do you say?
Well, I think that by sharing your story, and while a death cafe is not a grief support group, we always tell people that we still have, you can talk about anything related to death and dying. So we have people that are going through grief, but as long as they're able to talk about what they're going through and death, then that's fine. And I think that by just sharing your story with others is very cathartic, and that helps other people, and people share their stories.
But what about this balance that she asks about between talking about death, but maybe finding a balance between talking about it and dwelling on it? Jill?
Right.
Or Megan?
Well, and I think that you don't have to dwell on death, but just by talking about it, I think that you'll find by... And that's the great thing about Death Cafe as well, is that you go there and you're talking to usually strangers. And that's why people like it, because you go there, you talk to strangers, you say what you want to say, and then you leave. And so it's different. I don't know. It's kind of a different thing. And so you're not, I don't feel like you would dwell on it, but then you're able to, I think that if you try it, you'd be able to live your life more fuller, but just from that experience.
Let's turn now to Liz in Lawrence. Hi, Liz.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. This is a great show. I wanted
Thank
to
you.
Raise one of the real issues about not wanting to talk about death. My mom passed away of a terminal illness. It wasn't a surprise, but her unwillingness to talk at all about the practical side of death meant that when she did pass away, we had no idea what kind of funeral she wanted to have. We didn't know which cemetery she would have liked to be buried in. We just were so clueless. And any kind of conversation about death would have been really welcome for the survivors.
Did you struggle just amongst yourselves to wonder whether you were doing what she would have wanted, or was maybe the fact that what she wanted was not to think about it some consolation?
Boy, that's a hard question. You know, I think we were really concerned that we didn't end up doing what she would have wanted. But I guess the fact that she didn't want to talk about it meant that she didn't really care, or at least that's how I reconciled myself to that.
Yeah.
That happens sometime. And that does remind me of a wonderful story, though. My boss, Kathy, sat her son down. He had decided to go into the Air Force. And she said, you know, if you were to die, it would be one of the most tragic things that could ever happen in my whole life. But that being said, you have not chosen a profession that is the safest to go into. And we're going to plan your funeral. So they sat down and they talked about practical sides, you know, burial, cremation, whatever. But then they also got to know each other more about their favorite books and experiences. And it became this conversation totally centered around life, not necessarily the death. They got some of those matters out of the way, the things that they would have to go through if he were to die.
As a funeral director yourself, are you often in a position of working with people like Liz who haven't had directions, who don't know how their loved one feels about these things?
It does happen. By the time we get a lot of these phone calls, the conversation hadn't been had, so it's too late. So I guess that's one of the things we really advocate, is just being able to do that educational planning and find that guide that knows about the practical sides of dealing with death, whether it's in hospice or a funeral setting.
We see that in hospice as well.
Yeah.
People come on and they still don't want to talk about it.
Even as they're dying.
Yeah. And I, if I can share a quick story with you, my dad doesn't care that I talk about this. He has told me I can tell you this, so that's why I can't. But he came to my very first death cafe, and just to support me. And then he started coming to every single one. And I had been trying to get him to tell me what he wanted for years when it came to death. And then, you know, both his brother and sister died within 5 months of each other. And he was the last surviving member of his family. And so he's came to every single one of my death cafes. And he gets so much out of it. He loves it. He laughs. It's just unbelievable. But since then, he has picked out every single one of his funeral songs. He's decided what kind of funeral he wants. He's done all these things. Then he has also, and this goes with the living part, there's things that he's procrastinated on for like 15 years that he's stopped procrastinating on. He's actually started doing.
Like what?
Which is huge. Well, just things like for his house, for instance, that he's been saying for years that he's going to start doing, but he's never done. Well, he's starting to do that now. And so that's a huge thing for him.
I'm going to quickly, go on.
And I was just going to say, and then he thinks it's funny to every time I get in the car to play his funeral songs.
Oh no.
But it's a good memory for us though, because Jill was saying, there are things about his life that he's been teaching me along the way. And there's one song that he wants to play, How Do I Help You Say Goodbye, that I feel like is his legacy. That's going to be his legacy to all of us, you know? So it's very sweet.
That is very sweet. We're going to turn now to Kate in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Kate.
Good morning.
Please share.
I will. 2 years ago, I got kind of what you would call a death sentence. I was diagnosed with stage 4, you know, really unusual, violent, you know, cancer. And so I actually did face death, and just about last week, you know, I went back and, you know, I've had surgery and chemo and radiation and everything, and I'm just clean. I don't have cancer right now. But what it's done is it gave me a completely different outlook on life. And somebody said recently on Facebook, they said, you live every day, you only die once. And so I think everybody should just kind of live in the moment and to the fullest, you know.
Kate, during
and
those...
I talk about it to people. I've talked to everybody at work knows about it. They all know my whole story. I don't keep it a secret. And my family and my friends, you could ask any friend, they know exactly what songs I want to be played. And they know where I want my ashes to be. You know, I've pointed it out. Everybody knows. And, you know, of course, you know, when you go in for, you know, major cancer surgery like that, you have to sign a directive about what you want to have done. And that's really when we kind of started the death discussions within our family.
Great.
But you're right. I could be on my way to work this morning listening to you and then had to get in the office to call. I could have been in a wreck. I could be dead right now.
Right. And we are glad you're not, I should say.
Yeah.
Kate, just a quick question. We've been talking about how people are sometimes uncomfortable talking about death. During that 2-year period, did people seem uncomfortable, though you were very comfortable talking about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really put some people off.
Well,
you know, and they didn't know quite how to handle it. But, you know, that's just the way it is. And I think this, you know, I've never heard of the Death Cafe. That's really an interesting concept, and I'm going to explore it more. I've worked with, you know, I've been to some classes with Turning Point. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they help people with, you know, issues like that or people who have serious illness in their families. And, you know, I've gotten help like that. And I've also gotten help from my actual, the hospital and the caregivers
thanks.
You know, psychologists and everything. But
that's great. Thank you so much, Kate.
Turn.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling.
And that is such an interesting thing. Something that comes through in her voice and that, Megan, you've mentioned in your conversations with your father is that sometimes people can find humor and levity in these kinds of moments. Do you think that that serves an important purpose?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. And from my death cafes, there's usually, and from talking to other death cafe hosts around the world, is that you'll find that there is mostly laughter at the death cafes. And there are some somber moments, absolutely there is, but usually it's full of laughter. And you know, because you can't talk about death without talking about life. And so there's so, and every death cafe is different. And out of all the ones I've held, there are different topics that get brought up. And
it's, yeah, it's all led by the attendees. So
yeah, so they bring up whatever they want to talk about, and it's so beautiful. It really is, just to witness it.
Jill, when we talk about the death cafe, we've left out an important piece, which is that people are eating and there's snacks, and it really is an informal social setting. Can you talk about the importance of doing things like having cookies? What does that accomplish for the conversation?
Well, yeah, I mean, those types of things help set the mood. I mean, you think about coming together around a table or gathering, finding something to relate to, and food is often that. I mean, at the next session, I'll even make sure to have some gluten-free items for all of the middle-aged sensitive bellies. But
me too, and I'm not middle-aged.
it's becoming all the rage, gluten-free. But anyways, food is also a conversation starter. And so I think to have that everybody can engage in is important. Yeah.
And Jill, we're going to be getting out of here in just a second, but any thoughts about what you've learned through being present at these death cafes? The one that you had last night, for example?
Gosh, I just like how everybody comes together and they know that they've got permission to talk about whatever they want to talk about. That really was what it's all about.
Yeah. And, What going forward do you hope to learn? Is there anything that you, even as a funeral director, still have to learn from all of this?
Oh, absolutely. And just like everybody else, I'm working on my own belief system, you know, all of these things. Death Cafe is definitely for me, too. I mean, I love every time that we hold a session. But we don't necessarily always draw conclusions, but we at least get some good conversation going.
Well, thanks so much. That's been really interesting. I'd like to thank Megan Mooney, host of Death Cafe in St. Joe, and Jill Bedell, host of Kansas City's Death Cafe. Thanks so much, and best of luck to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
They're having another event tonight. We'll put information about that on our website later in the day. But for now, we're going to turn our attention to a regular segment we do here on KCUR. That is our Tell KCUR segment. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm sitting here with KCUR's community engagement reporter, Laura Ziegler. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina.
This week, we've been asking our listeners the following question. Should the Kansas City Chiefs change their name? Why or why not? And Laura, what did we hear?
Well, of course, it's in the context of this debate, Gina, about the Redskins and they're losing their patent. And in response to the question we put out, we heard several different categories of things. We heard people who were offended by the Redskins' name but weren't offended by the Chiefs, people who were offended by the Chiefs' name, people who don't mind the Chiefs' name but think some of the rituals surrounding the games are offensive, like the war paint horse and specifically the tomahawk chop, and then people who just felt really passionate about it and responded with a lot of feeling.
Well, let's talk about some of those. The first category you kind of mentioned were people who were offended by the Redskins' name, but not by the Chiefs' name.
Right. Well, we heard a lot of those, actually. The Voice on Facebook wrote this. He or she said that Redskins should go, and so should Chief Wahoo. There is no racism, however, this person said, with nicknames such as Indians, Blackhawks, or Sioux. And, quote, I apologize for that group of my fellow natives who can't seem to accept a compliment when they see it. Also on Facebook, Alexander Dyer wrote, Chiefs is a title of power and respect. I work at the fire department, and our supervisors are chiefs. Redskin is derogatory. It's okay to name a team after a group of people. That's not derogatory. And Laura Allander tweeted this, Chiefs is not derogatory. Redskins is.
But then some people are offended by the name.
Right. Chada tweeted, change the name. It's unconscionable to use racial or ethnic identities as mascots. On Facebook, Jason wrote, even if the name is okay, the culture that surrounds the Kansas City Chiefs is unacceptable. This is a team that beats a large war drum before games, has a mascot that is named War Paint, and has too many fans dressing as Native American characters. The popularity of the tomahawk chop serves to illustrate the callousness to cultural appropriation that the Chiefs fully endorse as an organization.
And so then we've heard a little bit about, oh, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say that idea of the tomahawk chop, as I said earlier, came up a number of times negatively. We got this call from Scott Gregory, who says he doesn't mind if he doesn't mind the name the Chiefs, but says that notion of the chop has got to go.
I'm a member of the Cherokee Nation. The problem with the Redskins name is that Redskins is sort of the Native American equivalent of the N-word, and should definitely be done away with. The Chiefs, the issue is marginal. It's maybe easy to say, okay, it's a sort of a tribute to Native Americans. I think the problem is it leaves the door open for ignorant and insensitive fans to do that stupid tomahawk chop.
Yeah, I think that's interesting coming from somebody who's actually a Native American himself. And, of course, that resonates with the debate about the Redskins.
Right.
Which has been a national debate and something that has been really ongoing for a number of years here in Kansas City as well.
You talked about that some of our listeners and some of our responders on Facebook and Twitter had really responded with a lot of emotion. Could you talk more about what you meant by that?
There were a number of people. By the way, I will say that we got a lot of responses to this question. It really did seem like something that people had a lot to say about. And a number of those people, as I said, felt really passionate about this topic and felt like it was a really important subject and expressed it in pretty strong feelings. Aaron Cash suggested on Facebook, quote, people were misguided about this debate. He says the Chief's name comes from the former Kansas City Mayor H. Roe Bartle. So we're not even talking about the, we're not, our debate is completely off topic.
But that is hard to really wrap your mind around when there's the symbol is the tomahawk and the stadium is called Arrowhead.
Yeah, it doesn't really, I mean, there is no reference to H. Roe Bartle, so I guess if you don't know that little piece of history, it might be hard to know that. But anyway, he said H. Roe Bartle was called chief and he was very instrumental in getting the team here. Jeff from Northeast called us, and he echoed Aaron Cash's remark. He left a message that the team was actually named for the illustrious former mayor, and he suggested that if we can't agree on a name, maybe we should just use the Hey Yous.
But what about this issue of a lot of emotion? Who was it who responded with a lot of emotion? Where did you hear that?
Well, there was a woman who identified herself, I think facetiously, as Louise Bleeding Heart Liberal. And on Facebook, she said, could we consider changing the name to Kansas City Native Genocide?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Laura, if people want to continue this conversation, where can they go?
They can go to Facebook, our Facebook page, www.kcur.org, and click on Facebook. They can tweet us at KCUR, and they can call us on our call line, which you'll hear on the next promo.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Laura Ziegler, community engagement reporter.
You're welcome.
Double tight, both left. Now Gonzalez motion right. Off tackle, lead play. Holmes gets a block from Richardson in the backfield. 15, 10, 5, juking right. Touchdown, Kansas City. Touchdown, Priest Holmes. A 31-yard touchdown run. And a great downfield block by Jason Dunn.
The Chiefs' name may be contentious, but the team is as much a part of Kansas City as anything could be. Wide receiver Eddie Kennison grew up in Louisiana. Although he's played for the Saints, the Bears, the Rams, and the Broncos, Kennison is passionate about ending his career as a Chief. As part of our Go Into Kansas City series, we talked to Kennison about what brought him here and what made him a true Kansas Cityan. It turns out that around the time he joined up with the Chiefs in 2001, his wife was diagnosed with lupus.
We didn't know what it was. So trying to figure out what do we do because our life is changing dramatically on everything that we do on a daily basis. And then it got to the point where we kind of understood what it was, We had a sense of direction on where our life was going, raising our kids, all of those fun things. And then we jumped in 2003 and say, okay, what can we do to make a difference? And we started our foundation, Quick Start, the Eddie Kennison Foundation, and everything just kind of took off from that point. The overall goal for the foundation is research, getting the word out there about what lupus is, and giving the people the knowledge and understanding of how critical lupus is. The community of Kansas City, they're giving people, and it's not just about money. They're willing to give all of their time if necessary. And they show up, and they show up in big numbers, and they show up on time, and that's what makes Kansas City unique. When you're moving around in the National Football League, you never know what to expect. I mean, you know it's football. You know you have to go to work. It's going to be physical. It's going to be tough. It's going to be a grind, all of those things. But what Kansas City showed my family and I, the organization and the city, when we first came, and they took my entire family, and they just said, welcome to Kansas City. We love you. We want you to be here. We're glad that you're here, and let's make some great things happen. You think about how many professional athletes have actually retired and stayed in Kansas City. There are some that have played in Kansas City, whether it's for the Royals or for the Chiefs, have moved away and come back. Will Shields still lives here. George Brett from the Royals still lives here. They enjoy it, and they love it. I wanted to retire as a Chief, one, because the organization, they treated me so well and with so much respect and with open arms. And I played the majority of years here in Kansas City. And the fans here are just phenomenal. My wife and I and our kids, it grew on us. And Kansas City just continues to grow on us every day. And I wanted to remain and retire as a Chief because this is home.
Eddie Kennison signed a one-day ceremonial contract with the Chiefs so he could retire as a member of the team. That story was produced by Suzanne Hogan. If you have a unique story about what brought you to town, let us know. Email goingtokc@kcur.org. That's all the time we have for Central Standard this morning. Tune in tomorrow to hear from our resident food critics. They'll help us find the fresh, cool drinks that make summer awesome. Last time they visited, they talked about cocktails. The refreshing drinks on tomorrow's menu will be of the non-boozy variety. Lemonade, fresh-squeezed juice, you get the idea. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, along with interns Christina Leffring and Matt Hodapp. Linda Scher is our announcer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.